Commander Edmonds, Real One. Can you tell me about the job and rank you had in the Navy when the crisis of the Falklands broke out, please?
Yes, I was a Lieutenant Commander and I was the Operations Officer and Squadron Warfare Officer for Above Water Warfare in HMS Broadsword, which was the senior ship in the 6th Frigate Squadron. And we had just completed a series of beginning of the year training exercises. The first one was called a Joint Maritime Course, JMC, and that would have been JMC 821. From that we had gone on to do spring train, which took place in the approaches to Gibraltar from both the Atlantic side and the Mediterranean. And the day that the Argentinians invaded the Falklands, we were in Gibraltar for the rest and recreation weekend with some 14 or other 15 ships and submarines.
Did the news come as a total surprise to you or not?
Well, yes, it did. We were aware that there was some trouble in the South Atlantic, but after some 6 weeks at sea with very little break at weekends doing both these exercises, we did not think, we hadn't seen heard much of the news, and didn't really think there was anything more than had occurred before in the late 70s, and that the problem would go away. And so when we were in Gibraltar, rest and recreation, clearly there was a fair amount of to-ing and fro-ing from the flagship, and coming and going of nuclear submarines, which raised the interest. But we were on our way to the Far East to take part not only in patrols in the Persian Gulf, but also to visit Malaya and Singapore. And therefore, we didn't really think it was going to affect us very much.
What's happened to you as soon as the news reached you?
Well, it was clear that a task force comprising some of the ships that had been in Gibraltar and would be sent southwards. And the initial selection, I think, was three Type 42s, which would have been Sheffield, Coventry and Glasgow, the Brilliant, and I must confess it was a fifth ship whose name I forget, were sent southwards at short order on, I think, Monday, April the 3rd or 4th. But we weren't selected, and ourselves and the ship going out to the Far East, which was the Yarmouth, in fact, sailed on our scheduled eastward passage, and we were well on our way to Naples. In fact, we were 2 days east of Gibraltar when we were turned around, brought back to Gibraltar, re-ammunitioned, and took on all the stores we could cram into the ship. And then we were sent south to link up with Invincible and Hermes, who had already sailed from Portsmouth. So we followed the first group of five ships. I remember the other ship in the first five was Glamorgan.
What was the atmosphere aboard ship when the news broke? Was it one of excitement or dismay or what?
Well, a bit of both. Our first port of call, had we gone east, was Naples, and a number of wives and girlfriends were flying out to Naples to meet us. And, of course, we had planned summer holidays with the families coming out to Malaya, Penang and places. And so there was a disappointment that we were not going to the Far East. There was some dismay because we still didn't really believe that the situation or the problem in the Falklands would be resolved by a fight. The Argentinians had backed down before when the Sabre had been rattled, and therefore we thought that sending an ever-increasing number of ships down there would probably in the long run be futile. Nevertheless, our squadron operations officer, Lieutenant Commander John Rodley, was talking to us at lunchtime. We were chatting on the upper deck at the lunchtime break, sunbathing, needless to say. And he said, well, come on, chaps, if something really does happen down there, we'll all be bitterly disappointed to have missed it if we're stuck out in the Far East. And so I suppose that encapsulated what we felt, that it was very disappointing not to go to the Far East, that the likelihood of anything happening going south was minimal, but if something did happen, then and we were not there, then we would feel left out.
Can you tell me more about your own job, what more specifically it involved, and the kind of preparations you personally had to make for going down there?
Well, as the operations officer of the ship, and the officer also responsible for above-water warfare, that's the missiles and the guns, I was responsible first as the operations officer for the day-to-day planning and running of the operations department and the ship's program. And therefore, it fell upon me to ensure that the operations department was properly trained for its task and that everyone had a good understanding of their part in that task. Of course, then also responsible for the missiles and the guns. And I should add that a Batch 1 Type 22 is mainly missiles. The only guns we had were two 40-60 Bofors, one made in 1941 and the other one made in 1943 by Otis Lifts in Canada. That I then also had to ensure that my sub-department of my overall department was equally properly trained. It was the policy in those days that the close-range guns that were fitted to the ships, very little training took place, and we didn't have an official guns crew for either of the 40-60s. It was felt in those days that the Royal Navy's prime role was ASW in the Mid-Atlantic, and the need for small caliber guns was minimal, and that if it was likely to use them, then someone could come out and train you at short notice. And the training, we had to select and train guns crews from the ship's company. And we, in fact, we chose our Royal Marines to man the 40-60 guns.
What about the complement that you had at the time, as far as their experience and so on was concerned?
Well, we were very experienced. HMS Broadsaw was the first Type 22. And although I hadn't been on board from the very beginning, I joined the ship in mid-1980. And the prime task we had at that time was to ensure that Seawolf, which was a new missile system then, completed its fleet acceptance trials. And so we spent a considerable amount of time in various parts of the world, including the West Indies and Aberporth off West Wales, putting the system through a large number of trials, and the majority of which were very successful. Of course, in doing those trials, we had a very good knowledge of how the system worked and indeed what its failings were at that time. And certainly, by the time I was heading south, I'd fired well over 90 Seawolf missiles in one trial or another, and indeed in workup. At the end of the trials, which was mid-1981, the ship had a lengthy maintenance period, and then from September to end of October 1981, we went for sea training and workup and became a proper part of the fleet. And then we'd had an exercise at the end of 1981 in November, December, an exercise in January, February, another exercise in March and April. So the ship was actually very well worked up. And we set off for the Falklands at a very high peak of training and capability. So there really wasn't much training to do except just to tighten up our procedures. And of course, sailing with a large group of ships, we were able to keep ourselves at quite a high peak.
Can you tell me what the voyage southwards was like for you?
Boring, really. We were sailing south towards the southern autumn, but going to the tropics, it was much as you would expect. I mean, it was sunny and calm, and other than exercising some of the drills that were necessary to bring us totally up to scratch, such as training the guns crews and doing lifeboat drills and so forth, and there wasn't an awful lot to do. It was a matter of general housekeeping, discussing how we would play our watchkeeping routines, were there any additional things we should do to prepare the ship. Other than that, it was already laid down in our sort of transition to war orders. There was nothing. There were a number of meetings on other flagships, and I was involved certainly in one of those where we flew from Broadsword to the Invincible, where the two air groups met to discuss how we were going to conduct air operations. And that was an interesting event. I was taken along merely because I was the expert on Seawolf, and nobody else understood or knew the system, except that it was fully automatic and liable to shoot down anything that came within range. And of course that gave the air crews some concern. And I was required to give a very short brief to tell them that it wouldn't. And the meat of this particular meeting between Admiral Woodham and Captain Black and Captain Middleton, Captain Black from the Invincible, Captain Middleton from the Hermes, was to discuss how air operations would be conducted. And that was quite fascinating because there were a number of commanding officers who were aviators at the meeting. Captain Middleton himself was an aviator and had been a Buccaneer pilot. And Captain Black was, of course, a submariner and had very little knowledge about aviation at all. And we, after an emergency landing on the way there in the Hermes, we eventually reached the Invincible. And the meeting commenced with a general question from Admiral Woodard, which was, well, how do we see ourselves playing the air operations? Because clearly we were not going to remove the Argentinians from the Falklands unless we had some form of air superiority. And quite clearly the two aircraft carriers were at loggerheads as to how this was to be conducted. Captain Middleton later became a rear admiral. A Buccaneer pilot was all for using the Harriers for low-level strike to drop bombs, fire missiles, and generally cause mayhem to Argentinian troops on the ground to suppress their air defenses by aggressive action. On the other hand, the Invincible air group were much more concerned with their defense of the ships. Because clearly we had a shortage of aeroplanes compared to what the Argentinians in theory could put up, it was in their view more of a Battle of Britain type activity where you allowed the Argentinians to come all the way out to the ships and then we could shoot them down in great numbers. And you achieved air superiority not by destroying the defences on the ground but by shooting down the enemy as he came towards you. And the two air groups could not be reconciled as to which is the best way of doing it. And Admiral Black said, Admiral Woodard said, right, well, we can't have this sort of en passe. We will have two separate air operations. We will have Captain Middleton's group doing the low-level air attacks and Captain Black's bunch doing air defense. They all realized, of course, that would stretch a limited number of Sea Harriers to the limit, and that we had to select one or the other. And it was quite interesting how Admiral Woodward eventually persuaded them that the best way to use the limited number of airplanes they had was primarily for air defense, to bring the aircraft out to us to shoot down, and then occasionally allowing combat air patrols to go over the islands, dropping the odd bomb on the way, except for specific operations. And the meeting did break up in some disarray or acrimony between the two. And clearly, Invincible and Hermes, in our minds, were never happy in each other's company. It didn't help that the admiral who favoured Captain Black, they're both submariners, was on the Hermes, where Captain Middleton resented having a submariner admiral in his aircraft carrier. And that was always a noticeable bone of contention between the two carrier groups. And it was even more interesting that we had Captain Middleton's son as a pilot on board Broadsword. And therefore, he received letters from his dad, or notes from his dad in the sort of sea mail that went between the ships, which sometimes indicated that the relationship between Admiral Woodward and Captain Middleton was not all that it should be.
And you were happy about the Seawolf as you went down?
Oh, yes. I mean, we were very happy with Seawolf as it stood. We knew its limits. It was and is an excellent missile system. And we were convinced that, given the right conditions, it would provide us with the sort of defense that we would like. But the two Seawolf ships that went down, Broadsword and Brilliant, were allocated one to each aircraft carrier, Broadsword to the Hermes and Brilliant to the Invincible. to provide close-in air defence, neither carrier having the sort of system that Seawolf provided, the sort of air defence that Seawolf provided. Invincible did have Sea Dart, but really what they wanted was an anti-missile defence, and Seawolf was primarily put up as an anti-missile missile system. We were always concerned, you see, about the Exocet threat from Argentina, and we were convinced that Seawolf had no problem taking out an Exocet missile. And so on the way south, one of the things we did practice considerably was close-in manoeuvring to the aircraft carriers. We would be within two cables, 400 yards, of the aircraft carrier and towards the threat. So we would shield them either with just the ship, or hopefully with the missile system. And that was a tactic we practiced, and of course was one we then started to use to protect other ships when we moved into the Falklands itself. But as you know, on the way down, all the ships stopped at Ascension Island for a few days, some for longer. The amphibious ships stayed there for a considerable amount of time once they put their stores in the right order. We stayed at Ascension for two or three days, painted everything grey. Ships in those days had quite a lot of fancy paintwork, but everything was painted grey. The ship side numbers were painted out, and we made the sort of final preparations you would before you go into a war zone.
Did you have any members of the crew who expressed doubts about going into a combat zone or about the war, this specific war?
I think there were some who probably expressed doubt as to whether this was the right way to solve the problem. But if there were, I can't remember them ever reaching my level. I think on the whole we felt fairly confident in our own ability. And Broadsword being the squadron leader for the frigate squadron, of course, had a lot of very experienced people on board. And it was a very well-run ship, and indeed it was a very happy ship. We were all easy in each other's company after, certainly most of us had been together for about a year and a half. And there were people who were fearful of missiles and submarines. But it never reached in anybody a crisis where it became dominant in their thoughts, where their imaginations would run away with them, such that they were forever frightened. I certainly can't. There was nobody, not even in the Chinese laundry, who doubted that we would do quite well and give a good account of ourselves, and that the ship would not survive any action. It was really quite a happy, contented bunch of people, contented in their own company, and therefore you felt you could rely on each other. It wasn't the same in some other ships, but we were fortunate.
Did you ever have anyone who had premonitions of being killed?
No. We had a good padre on board and a good doctor. We took great care to make sure that the routines we'd been working in exercises were the same routines that we worked when we went into the war zone, into the exclusive zone, TZ. And therefore, nothing was really different to being in exercise. As you will be aware, most of wartime is extremely boring. And for 99.9% of the time, you're not doing very much at all. And the real thing became to make sure that the routines were maintained, that the meals were adequate and enjoyable, and that people, when clearly nothing was going to happen, if intelligence indicated to us that nothing was going to happen, you could stand people down to catch up on sleep. And that worked very well.
What do you remember happening next to you as you headed south?
Well, of course, it got colder. But leaving, there were a number of silly incidents as people became more excited. I mean, as we left Ascension Island, there was the report of a periscope. And we spent a considerable amount of time bobbing around trying to discover whether this was a submarine or not. And as it was a visual sighting by a lookout on another ship, there was a feeling that there could have been some Russians around looking at us. And indeed, 2 days later, we were overflown by Russian reconnaissance aircraft, Bear Deltas, who had come from East Africa. Can't remember the name of the airfield they used to use out there. Conakry, from West Africa. It was one of the Russian forward operating bases in those days. And they flew out into the Atlantic to have a look at us and flew over the top, quite low. The next incident was the arrival of the Argentinian 707, which used to appear to see where we all were and do a ship count. Eventually, it was told it would be shot down if it appeared again, so it didn't. As we got closer, so we started to work defense watch routines, that's one watch in two, as opposed to cruising watch, which is one watch in four, and get people used to the sleeping and waking routine of a defense watch system. There is not, in the Navy, as an aside, an agreed way of doing defense watches. You have to break the 24 hours up into a number of watches, and ships used to work different routines for their own convenience. We had always favored doing 3 4-hour day watches and 2 6-hour night watches. So long as you have an odd number, it means you all shift round one every day, so you never do the same watch every day. And by adopting a forenoon watch of 8 till 12 and an afternoon watch of 12 to 4 and an early evening watch of 4 till 8 and then 2 night watches of 8 in the evening to 2 in the morning and 2 in the morning to 8 in the morning, it meant you didn't have to change the mealtime routines, so meals always came at the same time. And breakfast was always at 8 in the morning and so forth. You had the right meals at the right time. And the cooks kept to a routine that was familiar to them. So nothing really specifically changed. Some ships worked 3 8-hour watches, which is an appalling amount of time to be on watch, although it gave you more time to sleep when you were off watch. Other ships worked 4 6-hour watches, which meant you always kept the same watch every day. And it was notable, particularly when our staff and the squadron aviation officer and air engineer officer went out to other ships to see how Lynx flights were operating and how their maintenance routines were going, that ships who worked particularly 4 6s were more unhappy than the ships that worked 3 8s or 3 4s and 2 6s. We also made a conscious decision not to ditch the comforts of life. You obviously have to seal windows, seal mirrors if they're not metal ones. You have to try and reduce the risk of shrapnel from, or splinters from, the sort of peacetime sacrificial bulkhead cladding and so forth. And you have to make a conscious decision as to whether you're going to take up carpets and get rid of loose covers. We, in the end, decided to not take up carpets, not remove our loose covers, even though there's a risk that if the ship floods, they will float and clog up the pumps. As most of the accommodation was on 2-deck and 1-deck, if Type 22 floods above 2-deck, it sinks, so there didn't seem an awful lot of point pumping it out, and that's where all the accommodation is. And so we kept creature comforts so that when you came off watch, there was a warm and comfortable place to go to where you could relax. Other ships decided to reduce the heating, get rid of all the home comforts, and so they were virtually sitting in grey cells with no curtains, no carpets, nothing. And that made them very miserable. We allowed people, when they were off watch, to go to bed and even undress. It's very difficult to go to sleep when you're dressed fully booted and spurred. We allowed people to take some of their clothes off because it then convinces your mind that you're going to bed and not just resting. And all in all, that made for a more relaxed person. There is a risk, but we judged that the risk against a better and happier person was worth taking. And that was a deliberate policy that the executive officer, a chap called David Molam, the engineer officer, commander called Graham Tyson, the chaplain and the doctor discussed it and came to that conclusion, the best way to do it. And I'm pretty sure that's why the ship got through the Falklands without too much stress, and that after the Falklands, we only had one case of trauma about 5 years after the event, that I know of anyway.
Why do you think that case occurred?
That particular man was an able seaman missile, and he was involved in the rescue of the Coventry. The ship's company, the Coventry, were jumping over the side, and he took a Germany dinghy and picked up a number of people who were in the water. He didn't do anything, he didn't see anything particularly horrible. He didn't see dead bodies or carved up bodies or whatever. But I think probably just the surge of excitement and the fact he did actually take his Germany close into the ship when it was rolling over gave him some anxious moments. And in fact, the trauma only ever showed itself in this man when he was put inside the ship at Defence Watch. It was very noticeable when he was being trained as a leading seaman missile and he was put in an ops room and it got tense. It was almost too claustrophobic for him and he had to come out. And we then referred him for psychiatric treatment and they put it down to his experiences in the Falklands in rescuing the Coventry.
Now, if we can pick up the narrative with you heading south.
Mm. Well, as we continued south and started Defence Watch routines, obviously it became quite a large group of ships. And for a number of days, we had to go quite slowly whilst some of the store ships and the carrier group formed. And we became the close-in escort for the carrier group whilst the first five ships, that's Glamorgan, Brilliant. I'm not sure I got them all right, but Brilliant, Newcastle. Sorry, start again. Whilst the first five ships, that's Brilliant, Glamorgan, Sheffield, Coventry and Glasgow were down further down south, sitting on the edge of the 200-mile zone. So our passage south became quite slow. Brilliant, who was the senior ship of the first group, then had to take Glamorgan, one of the fleet auxiliaries, Tidepool, I think, and the Plymouth, who had been sent down to join them, to go and recapture South Georgia and Thule, I think. No, that was later on. But certainly Brilliant led Glamorgan and Plymouth and a fleet auxiliary down to recapture South Georgia. When that was complete, they returned north and we then, the whole group of ships linked up, Brilliant and her escorts linked up with us, and we provided a vast task group that headed almost due south down the central Atlantic and then turned due west and ran in towards the islands from the east. And we entered the TZ, I think, around about the 1st of May. The only other significant incident on the way south was the loss of a Sea King Mark IV helicopter who was doing a mail run. And that gave us probably our first casualty of the period when he just delivered mail to us and was flying on to the next ship. And under the control routines, he'd already been handed on to the next ship that was being his control. And shortly after we'd handed him on, he'd been accepted, he disappeared off the radar. And just, I don't know why, but he crashed into the sea. The pilot escaped, but